Welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. Let us help you escape your mind.
Folks, welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. We have episode number 270 tonight. If you have not already, go check out our fifth anniversary show that we did last week. It was a great episode. And looking forward to tonight's episode. We have a new guest, author and researcher Alec Hawkins. We're going to be talking about a few different things. I feel like, you know, he knows a little bit about Charles Manson since he had somewhat of a pen pal thing going on with him. So we're going to talk about the book Chaos, like MK Ultra, Charles Manson, all that kind of stuff, and then also all of his work in the occult. I have a link down below. You can check out Alec's book, which, you know, he wrote this book. It's called Scratch on the Lock. He is a horror slash fiction slash occult erotica publisher, and his publishing company is called Werecat Books. So yeah, we're going to have a great episode tonight. Before we get started, again, you can check out Alec's stuff. I have his YouTube channel and book all the way down below at the bottom. You can click on that, check that out. And yeah, check out our documentary trailer if you have not already. Our documentary will premiere March 10th through 12th at the Roswell UFO Expo, and really, really looking forward to that. The link for that is down below as well. If you would like to support Mind Escape, there's plenty of ways to do it. I just restructured all of our Patreon stuff for just, you know, $2 a month. You get all, you know, of our exclusive episodes and guest episodes and stuff like that. We do have a merch store, so if you were looking for some Mind Escape gear or a hashtag Let Maurice Speak t-shirt or We Are Living Breathing Magic, go check that out. Also, if you have not already, check out our other podcast. I do a podcast with producer Shane, who's over there, called the Roswell UFO Symposium. And please check that out on YouTube and subscribe. The link is down below. Yeah, all of our link trees, Mind Escape, Roswell UFO Symposium. And then again, check out Alec's stuff down below. And the best way to support the show is just leave us a nice review. Hit the like button, subscribe to our channel. We do our show live on YouTube, as well as Twitter sometimes, which we are doing right now. So if you are listening on an audio platform, check us out on YouTube. And if you are watching on YouTube, please check out all of our audio platform stuff, especially Spotify. We do have video episodes on there. All right. With all that out of the way, welcome on the show, Alec. How are you?
Man, I'm doing great. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much, Shane and Mike, for having me. Maurice, wherever you are, appreciate you, man. This is an awesome podcast, and I'm psyched to be here.
Awesome, man. Yeah, our buddy PD Newman connected us. If you haven't checked out our episodes with PD, please go do so. I think one of them we talked about his book, Alchemically Stoned. And then the more recent episode he was on, we talked about Angels in Vermilion, John Dee, and all that wonderful jazz. So go check out those episodes. And but yeah, man, I'm glad to have you on. And based on what you were talking about, there was a little synchronicity happening, which was when we were connected, I'm like, you know, what are you into? And you're like, oh, I, you know, had a you sent letters and received letters from Charles Manson. I'm like, that's weird because I'm reading Chaos right now. So there's a little bit of a synchronicity there. And yeah, from there, here we are. We're having a conversation. So why don't you give us a little bit of your background so we know a little bit about you before we get started?
So I kind of like became this accidental storyteller from my youth. I was really into movies. And if you want to make movies, you have to write a script. So the story was always just this necessary facet of making movies. And when I was in my teens, Mississippi's first film festival, the Magnolia, happened. So I went to the very first MAG, and I I kind of stalked the founder, made him my mentor, and I would write screenplays because I was just like seeking this male approval. And because I wanted to make movies, but I was really dead set on like, okay, this guy, like, I'm not going to make the movie till this guy tells me like your script is good. At the same time, I had a friend named Shane Ballard, and Shane, real eccentric guy, a pop culture sponge. He corresponded with everyone from David Byrne and Hugh Hefner to pretty much every living serial killer that you could mention. So I had my GL1 Canon camera and I'm just filming stuff all the time. I also had this little black dictation tape recorder that I was like recording stuff all the time because the people I was hanging out with, there was constantly music and just little toy instruments and weird stuff happening. So in all of this madness, my mentor, Ron Tibbett, who founded Mississippi's First Film Festival, was like, there's actually something kind of interesting happening here. You're trying to do like this weird avant-garde Andy Warhol stuff, but what if we made a documentary about Shane? And in all of that, I'm hanging out in Shane's house with another friend of mine, and we're cutting up and making noise, and Shane comes into the room on the phone. He's like, shut the fuck up! Shut the fuck up! And we're like, what's happened? Like, Shane's usually an easygoing guy. He's kind of being a jerk right now. What is he doing? So we just ignore him and keep like making noise and music. And he's like, no, Charles Manson is on the phone. And we're just like, I've never really known Shane to lie, but this is weird. So anyway, Shane was really talking to Charles Manson. He had come into some recordings that Charles Manson did September 11th, 1967. I believe this was when he, you know, Manson was in and out of prison all the time, which is really weird. Like, how does a guy get out of prison?
I mean, that was the main part of that book, too, was The Summer of Love, 67.
Exactly. So on September 11th, 1967, he records a demo, which Shane came into because he was, again, a pop culture sponge. He had YouTube, like early days of YouTube, in his house, just bootleg VHS tapes. He had like every Kenneth Anger film. And I was like, dude, I've always wanted to see a Kenneth Anger film. This was before it was out on DVD. So anyway, he reached out to Manson and said, I want to do this right. I want to professionally put out these demos, and any money I make from it, I know because of the Son of Sam law, you can't make money, but I can use the money to send you cigarettes, send you a guitar, whatever, whatever. And he left his name, phone number, and the letter. And that was Charles Manson calling him to say, dude, no one has ever done this before. That's amazing. Shane actually ended up sending him a guitar, which I think it's Corcoran Prison, if I'm pronouncing that right, did not let Charles Manson have. But I know he also sent him cigarettes and other things. But anyway, I had that little black tape recorder, and we put it in a bedroom with an old-fashioned phone and put it on speakerphone while Shane was in the other end of the house talking to Charles Manson, and we recorded these conversations. We didn't tell Charles Manson we were doing that. And anyway, my mentor, Ron Tibbett, ended up making a film called Citizen Shane, which documented...
I don't think you have to worry about morals with Charles Manson. So.
No.
Ethics and morals kind of go out the window.
Do whatever you want with him. Celebrity death match. If you can make that happen, do it. So Ron makes a movie called Citizen Shane about Shane's run for sheriff. Shane ran for sheriff when he was like 22, 23. He ran as a Republican on a pro-porn platform. Shane was all about performance art and just doing the thing, living the art life. And you can find the film Citizen Shane on YouTube. And it also has a sequence in the middle of it where you get that recording that I did of them. But Shane and Ron both end up dying right after the film comes out in 2004, summer of 2004. Some weird stuff. But anyway, so I was in my late teens at this point, and I'm not somebody who necessarily sought out to be a storyteller, and I'm not someone who set out to be a mystic or an occultist, but when these things started happening in my life, it was just like something inside me was like, yeah, just keep going towards that. So so that's my background. I I have found myself constantly involved in creativity and art, but there's also always been this religious and spiritual occult aspect to it. I ended up getting married, and I really wanted to have a son, and I was fortunate enough to be able to attempt to conceive a son with my ex-wife, and we did. And it was really peculiar because the town I live in, one of the oldest houses in this town, we kind of bid on, just because that's what you do when you're young and love and married. You think you're going to like bid on this old pre-Civil War house. But then we got the house and it made no sense. We actually, our bid was less than some of the other bids, but the woman sold it to us because she was like, I like the idea of a young couple getting this house. All the time I was like, no, the reason we got this house is because I'm doing some witchy stuff that I probably shouldn't be messing with. And I probably have spirits around me, and those spirits want to be in this old pre-antebellum house. So my son was kind of conceived in a time that I was definitely messing around with stuff that I wouldn't recommend anybody messing around with. There's plenty of books and information out there to where if you want to summon things and make things happen, you can. I think a lot of people just don't do it, even if they do read that kind of literature. But my experience has been, and you absolutely can do stuff like that. Unfortunately, what happens is people who do that end up kind of ruining their lives, or all kinds of things can happen because you're kind of messing around with things you don't understand very happenstance. And a lot of the occultists that I knew at the time were very focused on the stars and that kind of thing. Whereas I was like, no, let's just deal with like the earth and subterranean things and things that are a lot closer to the realm we live in now. And I was getting immediate results, but it got scary really quick. And about the time that my son was born and I had a few experiences with him that kind of terrified me, I was like, yeah, me and my son, we need to get baptized as soon as we possibly can. And maybe I should kind of reconsider what I'm messing around with. Because
entities around me right now. Check this
yeah,
out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting triggered. I'm getting triggered by what I'm seeing right now. I actually had a moment with my newborn son. It was a sleep paralysis moment where I was on the couch with him. His back was to the inside of the couch, and I was cradling him. And there was like an ET like bent over the couch, like trying to get him. And I was just like, you know, this isn't really a surprise, but I don't know.
You say, you know, you felt like you needed to get baptized. I was raised Roman Catholic, so I'm very familiar with religion. Went to religious. I'm not religious at all now. I see no, I mean, there's a moral value to it, you know, like community gives you like a good platform to be a good person. But in terms of like, there's other elements, obviously the obvious things, the problems with the church and stuff like that. But on top of all of that, I just felt like, you know, for me, I never felt close to anything going to church at any point in my life. And I felt closer to what I would think of as a god or somewhat of a spiritual energy. The first time I felt that was actually on a psilocybin experience, my first psilocybin experience. Mm-hmm. So I never felt close to anything other than in like altered states and like investigating things that are like esoteric or occult or things like that. Nor have I gotten any, like when you hear the word occult, you know, a lot of people associate that with like evil or demonic, but even the word demonic, I mean, it comes from daemon, which, you know, right. Socrates used to talk to his daemon all the time. Right. So, you know, things like that, like I don't look at this like a lot of other people do, which has like a, I know Shane disagrees with me a lot on this, but I've never had any real negative experiences. Maybe that's the energy that I'm putting out, or I don't know. I don't know how any of this stuff works, but I just feel like the inherently like creepy aspect of it or evil aspect of it, like I don't look at these things. I guess back to the baptism thing is I don't think of it as in like that's going to protect you per se. And I've been baptized myself, and I'm not saying that I just, those were human beings that came up with that ritual. Okay. So through those human beings, are they more, do those human beings have more knowledge, or, during that time when that was created, was there something else going on the earth, some presence or some energy or something, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, for me, it's like, I don't feel like that's done anything for me other than, you know.
I agree with your value judgment, the whole thing of like, if men made this up, I'm not interested in it. So I agree with you there. I think my thing was, I need to get back to what ancient man received from heaven. So that's why I went to the Eastern Orthodox Church, because as an academic, at my most agnostic, even though I've never considered myself agnostic, but let's just say when I was the furthest away from God, when I was, you know, doing ceremonial magic, which I believe a lot of people get into occultism because they feel a lack of control. So they're desperate. So like what you just said about the energies you're putting out, you know, it's like, yeah, if you're using these really base rituals, trying to summon terrestrial spirits to bring you sex and money and power, then yeah, you're probably coming from a place of desperation and you're probably putting out some negative vibes. But my value judgment was, if I find the true church, the people who actually received the truth and we're enacting heaven on earth, then that's what I want to get baptized into. Cause I was, you know, raised in the deep South where, you know, Roman Catholicism is seen as satanic, just like Freemasonry is, which is kind of weird to say since Freemasonry, what's left of it, is still flourishing in the deep South, cause the deep South is in the past in a lot of ways. But I think the United States were basically based on kind of an anti-Catholic idea. You know, we're a Protestant deist kind of country. We don't really believe in God. We just believe in when we meet, we eat. Let's talk about what this man at the podium's opinion of the scriptures are and have a potluck. So I was really attracted to what, as an academic, I was taught was like this ethnic Catholicism, where people have been doing these rituals in Ethiopia for 2,000 years. That's what I was hungry for. But I do want to say, for anyone who's interested in pursuing Orthodoxy or maybe even Roman Catholicism, you're going to meet a lot of terrible people. You're going to meet sociopaths who became priests because they're sociopaths. They're terrible people. So that in itself is a whole spiritual burden and a thing where, if you do decide you want to pursue a life in the church, expect to meet shit people, you know, but I guess that's part of the resistance and part of the struggle. I know it has been for me, and God forbid, I've probably been one of those shit people to someone who's coming to the church trying to find truth. So
yeah, it's, man, crazy. Yeah. No, I mean, I totally get it. For me, it's like, the last 5 years I've changed dramatically to the point where I used to kind of think I had an idea about who I was. And I guess now, I mean, I haven't been religious probably since I was like 11 or 12 until I kind of like, well, why are we right versus other people? And I just didn't understand the concept of, you know, one religion being right or wrong or the other, you know, like, so I started to question that. And then I realized, okay, yeah, this is not what I believe, but I didn't really revisit it till later. Like I mentioned, till I had some real mystical experiences. And then now I would consider myself spiritual and I'm very open-minded, but I don't really subscribe to one thing or the other. I look at almost like knowledge is my religion and I'm willing to change my philosophy day to day, depending on what I learn that day. So I've kind of just, instead of adopting one thing and really sticking to that one thing, I've really just become a chameleon of new ideas and philosophies and things that I can further my knowledge, I guess, if you will. But that being said, and I've talked about this many times on the podcast, there is value in religion. There is value in believing in a higher power or a higher being, if you will, or whatever, in the sense that it takes that pressure off your shoulders. You know, it takes some of that anxiety away. It takes the idea that, you know, like there is a value there, whether that exists or not. It doesn't matter, because the idea of it's real in the sense that, you know, you're getting something out of it.
I don't want to speak for Protestants, but I feel like what you just described is a very Protestant experience of Christianity, where it's like, once saved, always saved, like I'm good now. Whereas with Orthodoxy, it's like, oh no, I might go to hell. Not to say that Orthodoxy has this like guilt stuff, because I know that's the cliche with the Roman Catholics, like the Roman Catholic guilt. But as someone who is Orthodox, the afterlife is very much in my mind. Now, I'm not speaking for other Orthodox. I don't think a lot of Orthodox people think about the afterlife. In fact, it's very controversial. At least in America, because Orthodox people in America, priests included, just pretend like that's something we shouldn't talk about. You go to Slavic countries and there's all kinds of information. I don't want to call it lore, because that implies fiction, but you're just not going to hear Orthodox people talk about demons in the afterlife. Thank you, William Peter Blatty, for The Exorcist. Now Roman Catholics have realized that's something that people are interested in. So there's tons of Catholic literature on demons and the afterlife, not so much with Orthodoxy. And the good books that do exist out there, for whatever reason, American priests are like, don't read that stuff. Don't read it. But
let me ask you this. What about on like a psychological level? Because the way I look at it is like, and I've studied a lot of ancient civilizations, and, you know, I know a lot about the timeline of human civilization and history and the different cultures, from Göbekli Tepe to ancient Egypt, sure, the mystery schools, the Eleusinian mysteries, all that stuff. Do you think that whatever, you know, in terms of religion, do you think that that's just their understanding or interpretation of whatever this other thing is, whatever that is? Or do you think, like, because I guess I have a hard time believing that people back then, given, even though there might be esoteric knowledge or ancient knowledge that we can obtain and use to our advantage, I have a hard time believing that they would know more than we would know now based on our ability to measure the things around us. Or do you think it's a different type of a knowledge, meaning that they didn't have that stuff, so they were maybe more tapped into the energies around them on the earth or something like that, because they weren't so distracted with stuff? But I have a hard time thinking that these ancient people, you know, they were living through some time period where they knew so much more than us that we are like very lost, you know, compared to them. I find that hard to believe.
Well, it's a lot of stuff gets passed down orally. So, you know, a grandma might tell you something and you're like, well, Andrew Huberman was just talking about that, but my grandma has already knew about it. So I think some of it is just that mouth to ear, just oral tradition being passed down. I definitely think that ancient people in a way knew more than what we know now, because the naked eye can see so much. I believe that Christ fulfilled what people already knew. So I don't like the whole fallacy of like that Zeitgeist movie that I, you know, when it first showed up on YouTube a million years ago, it was very cool. But looking back at it, it's like, just because Osiris did something and Dionysius did something doesn't mean that Christ is a ripoff of these things. And the whole idea that you see every Christmas, where these neo-pagans who just want to say, oh, the Christians stole Yule from us. It's like, the Christians didn't steal anything from you. The pagans, with their naked eye, could look at the cosmos and figure out a lot on their own. And that's why when Christ lived on earth and died and rose again, it was real easy for his apostles to go out into the world and for people, again, in Ethiopia, Assyria, they were able to receive this gospel and be like, oh yeah, this makes sense. We already knew this stuff, and Christ is completing what we already knew. That's my opinion as a believer and as someone who studied this academically before ever converting. So I think it's really easy for someone to say, I think it'd be really hip to be a druid. I'm really vibing with it. I'm going to tell people I'm a druid now. But I don't really respect that because, number one, anything that's going to tell you how to be a pagan, and I mean, please forgive me if anyone listening to this identifies that way, and if I'm wrong, please educate me, but all that stuff comes from the 70s. All that stuff comes from, I can't remember his name now, but the British guy who invented Wicca. And all that goes back to Crowley, Dion Fortune, even a little Alice A. Bailey. None of that stuff is ancient. And that's cool if you want to do it. I just really resent the idea that people want to act like Christians just stole this stuff, when really it's a matter of people all over the globe using their naked eye and figuring out a lot of stuff. And whether it's a Genesis story, a creation story, or it's ideas about the afterlife, it's beyond freaky how much of it's all exactly the same. But for some reason,
I don't think they stole. Like, I wouldn't say they stole things, but I will say, I mean, you can just look at the iconography, you know, the Sumerian fish, there's so many things that are represented in symbolism in Christianity that have roots in previous cultures, including the Lord's Prayer is a prayer to Pita, which is an Egyptian prayer from, you know, the mystery school. So it's like they did take things. And I won't say I disagree with you on the Osiris thing. I think Jesus was an enlightened being, a real person. Now, did people really see his ghost or whatever? Is that an allegory? I don't know. But what I can say is that obviously this dude had some sort of transformational impact on people that still lives to this day. So, I mean, there's something there, right? But that being said, you know, I think that the Osiris myth does represent this like shamanic myth that's very similar to, you know, being taken to the underworld, being disassembled, you know, being put back together. That's, you find that in South America. You find that in, you know, even like Hades taking Persephone to the underworld, you know, and like, you know, the Eleusinian mysteries and all that stuff. I do feel like there is a common thread there. Noah's Ark is basically the Epic of Gilgamesh. I mean, those things do exist. And I'm not saying you're wrong, but I'm just saying that I do feel like there are foundations, and maybe, you know, the foundations of Christianity, you know, it's just influence like anything else, like how we influence, you know, you were talking about art and music and stuff like that. Like, things have an influence on us. I'm a huge Fish Grateful Dead head. I when I play the guitar, you can hear that my favorite guitar players are Trey Anastasio and Jerry Garcia. I'm not trying to sound like them, but those are my influence. Do you get what I'm saying? Like,
I hear what you're saying, but my thing is, I agree. There's bad people who call themselves Christians who came in and obliterated cultures, and that's bad. But where I disagree is, I've done meditations and ritual work where I saw myself at Petra being taken apart by Jin and disassembled, and I had no idea what I was seeing in my mind. And it was only years later, as an academic, that I was realizing this is consistent archetypal imagery that exists. So I do believe that it's a both and thing. And I mean, hell, it is documented that Christmas was originally celebrated on December 12th. But at some point, the Roman Catholic Church moved it to the 25th. And then in America, there's Eastern Orthodox who, to go with the norms, they celebrate it on 25th. But then you get other Christians who don't. So I do get that. But I disagree with the whole idea of Jesus was really born in September and blah, blah, blah. And that's taking it to another level where it's like, no, that's not true. It was always December. And
I like this conversation. I will say this, and I don't want you to feel like I'm combating you, because I'm not. But I just feel like
that's what we're here for.
The disconnect here, I believe, is this idea that something that those people knew about something metaphysical or supernatural far exceeds what we're capable of knowing today. Even though, like you said, you meditate, I meditate, I've done psychedelics, I've had mystical experiences that I can't explain, I've had weird paranormal experiences that I can't explain. However, I'm not going to look to the Bible to explain that for me. I'm going to take that knowledge and I'm going to take what I think are like the gold nuggets out of that and then apply that to my own philosophies, if that makes, do you know what I'm saying? Because there's a lot of outdated, crazy ideas in there too that have no bearing or make any sense in modern society, you know, as well as terrible, you know, racist things and terrible humanitarian things, you know what I'm saying? So it's like there are nuggets of truth in there. And I feel like, I guess that what I'm trying to say is that instead of like looking to those people and be like, oh, they figured this out, how about we take that knowledge and, you know, modernize it, I guess, if you will.
Well, I think part of the problem is we've got it so good right now. If things get worse, things will probably get a lot more racist and inequality and terrible. I think so, because I agree with you. There was a time where I was like, no, this is like Bronze Age stuff. This isn't applicable to now. So I think you kind of have to look at it that way, and also look at the fact that, you know, the people that are in those stories in the Bible are messing up all the time. But yeah, I'll give it to you. It's hard to reconcile. I mean, I'm someone who is finally kind of living their dream. Like being with y'all right now is something that I dreamed of just a year ago, and now it's happening. But at the same time, I mean, I just got a manuscript the other day, an erotic novel that is amazing. But I also am trying to reconcile this whole idea of, I mean, I'm a reader in the Orthodox Church, and I'm putting out a cult erotica. So it's like I've always felt like I've had one foot in this world and one foot in the other. But then at the same time,
do you watch It's Always
Sunny? Can I ask a question now?
Yeah, go
now
ahead.
Now I'm interested.
Yeah, jump in, Shane. Yeah,
let's
come
hear
on.
About that erotica, because I was trying to put the two together.
Of course, that's what Shane wants.
Well, no, we were discussing the orthodoxy, and I heard the supernatural erotica earlier, and I'm trying to put the two together because erotica is always good, in my opinion. But I was just trying to put the two together as you were discussing it.
All right, let's keep it G-rated. Let's keep it G-rated.
Yeah, G-rated.
But
I was just curious.
I'm a high school dropout who ended up after I left my wife and decided, you know, I'm going to live the art life. You know, I'm going to do this. I ended up going back to school, getting my undergrad, and then going right into a creative writing MFA program where genre fiction isn't really a thing. You know, they don't like to talk about genre. They don't like to talk about story structure. You know, Joseph Campbell is a bad person, you know, all that's bad. You know, I'm not going to get into any political or social stuff, but you can imagine the kind of prejudices that exist in MFA programs for creative writing. So once I got through all that, I realized it seems to me that where the real stories are, the real emotion, which I think is what all people want. We want to feel happy. We want to be happier. But what makes us happier is feeling emotions and experiencing stories. And I was like, that's genre. So these old archetypes and these old stories that never get old. And as someone who doesn't really know a lot of erotica, I mean, I read Henry Miller when I was younger and Anne Ice Nin, and I did pick up a couple of erotic short novels. I think I read two, and then I started Anne Rice's Sleeping Beauty book, which was probably the best one, but I didn't finish it. But I think that's okay.
Shane loves going to Walgreens and picking up those erotic novels that have Fabio on the cover.
I think it might be a mistake to read too much erotica, but again, I'm going against everything I was taught.
No such thing.
In grad school. It's like, instead of studying it, let me just do it. Because another thing that happened to me in grad school was we're in writer's workshops, and I loved some of the stories I read, but then everyone has to give, you know, feedback. So people are saying you should change this and you should change that. And then you've got this author who's written some really interesting stuff off the top of their head. And now they're trying to incorporate 20 different changes that might not even be legitimate changes. It's just people who are giving feedback for the sake of giving feedback. So if anything, I came out of grad school realizing first draft is usually your best draft. That's where the magic is. And also the things, and this is quoting Jean Cocteau, the things that people say are bad about your work, those are the things you need to lean into. So I looked at my own work, and there was a lot of weird psychosexual stuff. And I also realized, as a person that has great privilege in this world, I can offer a platform to other people. So that's kind of how Werecat Books started, where erotica seems to innately be more of a female thing. Men will just get on the internet to find images. Women want stories and kind of a long game. And I mean, it just happened the other day. P.D. Newman has this lifelong friend, and he has started writing fiction and collaborating with me after a career in academic research and writing nonfiction. So she reached out to him and said, how do I become a creative writer? And he was like, I really can't tell you how to do that because I've always written academic stuff. This fiction I'm doing is more of a fluke and just something I'm doing for fun. But I've got this friend, Alec, who is publishing occult erotica. And she was like, well, that's weird because the stuff I've written is literally pornographic. So anyway.
What is occult erotica? I'm sorry. I have zero clue what. Okay, I mean, I know what erotica is, but.
Excellent question. So the reason I don't call it horror is the same reason that when I tell people I love the horror genre, they automatically assume that I love gore and stuff like that. But I think my interest in horror has been because I kind of see sex and death as these two motivating things in human existence. You know, we know we're going to die and we know we want to fuck. So for me, that's why horror has always been so captivating. Plus it's like this forbidden thing. I mean, I remember in the 90s pretending to be sick so I could spend 8 hours while my parents were at work downloading on Netscape, like every Puppet Master trailer. And it would take like an hour. And by the time they got back from work, I might've watched 4 trailers. And I thought like, man, Puppet Master looks cool. I don't know what it is. I've seen
every Puppet Master, man.
Are we talking the Puppet Master, the real OG version with the dolls? Yeah. Or are we talking the fake one, which is like an alien thing?
No, I'm talking
about Robert Heinlein's The Puppet Masters. I'm talking
one with
about
the drill head.
Okay, yeah. That's the classic.
So, I mean, I think horror is very theological. I mean, it horror can deal with all this existential stuff that other genres don't.
Who is your favorite Puppet Master? Mine was the little dude with the white hair and the little hat.
Yeah, the Michael Jackson Puppet Master. Yeah.
I like mine was a drill.
Shane loves the drill head.
The drill dude is cool. But yeah, I mean, I loved all that stuff because like the horror section in Blockbuster or Movie Gallery or wherever you go, that was like the forbidden place. So
yeah, all those movies were classic. Critters, Puppet Master,
even Gremlins, which of course Gremlins was more. Yeah. I could watch that, but that was the occult section. That I mean, occult and erotica. Of course, that's what I'm doing now because it's like my mind has been primed since childhood to be like, what's beyond the door? What's that forbidden door?
You
got to
combine
has
them like occultica or something. You got to come erotica, up with a new word.
Yeah, it's like. Yeah. I want the door, either there's going to be Masonic volumes behind that door or there's pornography. And that's a joke.
I mean, No, that's why I had a joke I was going to say earlier before Shane cut in, which is, have you seen It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia? There's an episode where they talk about Dennis writes a memoir. It's called Dennis Reynolds, An Erotic Life. And I was going to make a joke. You should write one that says Jesus, An Erotic Life. And I think people will love that.
Well, that would definitely sell and cause a lot of controversy, which both those things are.
Oh,
are
that
good,
book
right?
That book would get burned for sure.
I've actually been listening to what's the band? They sing Christian Woman. P. Peter Steele, typo negative. And when at the end of Christian Woman, where he's like, Jesus Christ looks like me. It's hilarious. It's hilarious. Y'all should listen to it tonight. It's like a 10-minute song about a Christian woman. But at the end, Peter Steele is talking about how he looks like Jesus, which I guess is supposed to sexually arouse the woman he's singing to.
Well, I'm sure religious people love that. So I find all that interesting. You know, the religious stuff, I go, you know, I've said my piece many times. I'm not against religion. Like I said, I think it holds an, if you're doing it for the right reasons and you're a good person and you're not trying to enforce your views or thrust your views or evangelize your views onto other people, I think that, I think it's fine. And I think it can be, like I said, beneficial to take that load off your back of the anxiety or whatever it is to believe in something higher. And actually, we can even go take that back to philosophy and, Plato and Socrates in the dialogues would always talk about how a dangerous man is a man that has nothing, that doesn't believe in anything. And I think that we have a lot of dangerous people out there now, because there's a lot of people that just don't believe in anything. And I think that that's a dangerous way to live, in the sense that if you have nothing to look up to or fall back on, or just a higher power or higher calling, I think that you're lost. You're a lost person. And you don't have to believe in a religion, but I do believe that, you know, whatever, pick what it is. Is it, you know, is it panpsychism? Is it pantheism? Is it this idea that we're all one, or non-duality? Like, I don't care what it is, but I do feel like it is important to have some sort of higher power or higher calling, because I think it's, I think there's some truth in, you know, the idea that you do see decay when you have people not believing in anything.
I know that a lot of people that... Go ahead. Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, people in my experience that convert to the Eastern Orthodox Church, they were either agnostic before they converted, or they were Protestant. So they kind of struggle with the daily prayers. You know, you're praying throughout the day, you're venerating saints. And as someone with an occult background and who went through all the degrees of Freemasonry, that was actually great for me. I never questioned it, because I was like, yeah, this makes sense, which I think is really funny, because a lot of people in the Orthodox Church would probably think that's bad. But for me, it was like, I didn't have any of those problems. I was able to convert with really no resistance, because it made sense to me. In my Protestant experience, people just made up prayers. And those same Protestants may put down the Orthodox Church because they're saying, you're praying stuff, you know, from a piece of paper. You're praying prayers of men, just vain repetition. Whereas for me, it's like, well, what am I going to do? Read a Aleister Crowley book and try to find out how to have a spiritual life? So that's one of the reasons why it's appealing for me. I wouldn't say it makes life easier. It actually makes life harder. But I like it, because it's giving me an occult life, where if I'm doing it to the letter, I'm waking up in the morning and saying a certain prayer. Then at 9 o'clock, I'm saying a certain prayer. At noon, I'm saying a certain prayer. So it's like you're living a spiritual occult life. But anyway, that's all I want to say about that, Shane.
No, I was going to say that, to agree with you though, too, humans like routines. They also like, going through, I guess you would say, like with Orthodoxy, you go through this, I'm losing the word right now. So when you go to church every Sunday, you guys go through Mass, you go through the same thing repetitively, right? Right. Is that routine?
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It makes people feel normal. I was actually going to ask you, because for me, I was always an atheist up until, what do you think about UFOs?
That's cool. So I was really drawn to ufology when I was younger. I mean, the 90s were fucking fantastic. We had the X-Files and creepy stuff for kids. And I remember my grandma being like, you need to quit getting those UFO books at the Scholastic Book Fair. Those are actually demons. And thinking, grandma, what in the world? But now I'm like,
was your grandma on the Collins Elite?
I actually just ordered a book called Masquerade of Angels, and it'd probably agree with the fact that they're demons. So
one of the things that, the
reason I broached it to you was always being an atheist until I started having, man, this is so weird too. So seeing UFOs and seeing them continuously, but all I could compare it to was a religious experience. So Ezekiel's wheel, things like that. So in my head, I somehow think all these religions are the same, and it's something like that. Now, God, UFO, in my head are the same thing, which sounds weird, right? But I'm curious, do you think Orthodoxy, all these are just different, I guess, hats on the same thing? Or do you think some are wrong, some are right?
I wouldn't say that.
And I don't say wrong. I'd say, okay, let me say this. Well, what's the easiest way to say it without somebody end up killing us? So, yeah. Word it the way you best feel comfortable. That's, you know what I'm saying.
I feel like to Orthodox people, I probably come off as a perennialist, where it's like, yeah, you can look at all these world religions and see the truth, but I believe that Christ completes the truth. That's why I'm not Muslim. That's why, you know, I chose Orthodoxy, and I'm definitely with Mike on this idea of, you know, once you decide you have the truth, that can be just as bad as someone who doesn't have any truth. And that's something that I've really been struggling with my faith right now, where it's like, I want to submit. And because my experience with Orthodoxy has been, if you can't intellectually understand something, the church fathers teach, accept it in your heart and just go with it. And then you will begin to understand it in your mind. And
I shook my head because all this stuff you're saying, I do.
That also sounds like just you're programming yourself. But at the end of the day, you're going to get programmed somewhere. So
somebody put in the comments, shout out to Corbeck, they put Bigfoot erotica. And I'm just thinking,
come on.
I have a perfect one. Shane can do. It's called Bigfoot Small Dong, and I think that would be a perfect.
Ooh, that big toe can do some
thanks.
Stuff, baby.
No, not
I'm
you,
never
Shane.
You, I'm
no,
never
not,
showing you that again,
not,
bro.
Not you, Shane. I'm talking about Bigfoot. That's the
sure
name,
not me,
because
bro.
You
never
no, because you have a
send you those pictures, dude. Never
because you have a Bigfoot hat on, bro. Come on.
No, this is a Wounded Warrior hat.
Oh, it is. I thought that was your Bigfoot. Yeah. I thought that was your
call,
Squatch.
Bro.
I thought good that was call. The one where you got a Squatch walking across.
You heard it here first. Mike thinks every disabled vet is a Bigfoot.
No, that's
so,
not true.
No, hey, the reason I was kind of shaking my head is all these things you were discussing, like the way you feel and stuff, this is so weird to say. It's how I interact with, like I said, I'm not UAPs. You know, when I think, the things you're literally saying, I same thing, right? And I can't understand it. Can't begin to understand it. I just follow, kind of go along. That's why I'm almost in my head all the time thinking it's all the same thing, like God, whatever you want to call it. And it sounds like I'm a weirdo because I am.
No, it makes sense. I'll tell y'all a scary story. And the people listening, they may take from it that it's not about who's a Christian and who's right. It's just about the power of the mind. And maybe we're all in this spider web and maybe we're influencing things, or maybe we're just acting out the will of the spider.
Indra's net.
In 2017, I don't think I had left my wife yet, but we had been separated for the majority of the year, and it was coming. And, well, forgive me if I say something, but I'm going to say it. There was a guy who had kind of had this spiritual awakening when he took DMT, and he was going around the country giving people DMT, like kind of being their guide while they took it.
Jesus.
And P.D. Newman was one of the people that this guy was going to come to and give the experience. Now, Danny, P.D., and I had smoked DMT before. I hadn't done it as much, but I did it a couple of times. And yeah, I went in, and what I perceived, I went into the underworld. Like my intellect said, we're in the land of the dead. I mean, it's geometric shapes and all that, but my intellect was like, we're dead. So Danny's telling me that this guy is going to be traveling down to Mississippi and they're going to drink the jungle juice, drink ayahuasca. And when it got closer and closer to time, and Danny and I are talking about it, Danny was like, dude, I don't think this guy's coming to help me. I actually think this is for you. Because again, I was like in this crisis. Like I had asked a woman to marry me. I had asked a woman to lay down and conceive a child with me. And then I was realizing that, you know, I was gravitating to the Orthodox Church. She was already freaked out with my occult adventures, even though I thought she knew who I was and that was part of what we were doing, but you know, maybe not. So anyway, I ended up traveling up to North Mississippi to spend a night in a shed, and Danny and I were going to drink ayahuasca. And Danny had much more experience with DMT than I did. So when he drank it and immediately blasted off, I didn't want to drink anymore because I thought, you know, just physically at the time, Danny was a bigger dude than me. And I am a big dude. So I was thinking, you know, our guy kept saying like, Alec, you need to drink more. Like you've drank a lot, but you're wasting this opportunity if you're not blasting off. And I'm like, no, dude, Danny's over there. Like, no, I can't drink more. I didn't realize at the time, the more you do it, the less your body needs. So since he had done it more than me, it just took a taste and he was off to the stars. So after a lot of hesitation, I was like, fine, I'll drink some more. And still nothing happened. Well, Danny kind of came back to earth and told the guide he needed to relieve himself. So they left the shed, walked across this huge, I'm not going to call it a farm, but just imagine kind of a farm in the woods, and went back to the main house and left me alone in the shed. And there was this weird like pipe above my head, and I started to hear a buzzing. And that buzzing sound came down into my ear.
Was it a high frequency hum like that?
Right. And the next thing I knew, I was going, and I was buzzing. And they told me after the fact that they could hear me across the way as they were entering the house. And they were like, well, anyway, I won't give you a whole lot of details of what happened to me. But before we did this, the guide said, you know, write down a list of the things you want to achieve, any clarity. You know, he was like, for example, I've dealt with like alcoholics and they don't want to drink anymore. So they go into their DMT trip trying to do that. So out of the things I wrote, I know one of them was, you know, my concern for my son. Like I definitely want my son to be okay because I'm a child of divorce. So I was very sensitive to that issue. And another thing I wrote down was, I want to find the Orthodox Church because the Orthodox churches in my area were very not good people. You know, just the kind of people who they want you to come and get their numbers up. But then once you've served your purpose, you know, and let's face it, when you're a divorced person in any Christian community, you're subhuman. So anyway, I wrote that down. I was like, Orthodox Church. So the whole point of the story is, on October 17th, I was flying in the stars and having a very traumatic, intense experience. You know, I thought I was dying. I mean, it was awful. You know, I had just applied to grad school and I thought like, man, you know, my professor is going to be like, hey, I got Alex's application for grad school, but he died in the shed. You know, my son's going to grow up without me. So it's kind of like your just classic, you know, experience. October 17th. So later on in 2018, I'm driving to the public library in my town because I knew they had a good collection of Roman Catholic theology books. And I had just kind of said, I'll never be Orthodox, but maybe for a sense of community and a sense to be a part of some kind of ritual, I'll go to the Roman Catholic Church. So let me kind of figure out their theology. And as I'm pulling into the library parking lot, the old Christian Science building that's been abandoned and emptied as long as I can remember, had a little sign in front of it that said St. Catherine Orthodox Church. And there was a phone number. No, it was an email address. And I was like, this is crazy. So I emailed the person and told her my story. And she said, we're actually going to have our first service this Sunday. Come and see. So I went to the church. It's the church that I ended up being baptized and chrismated in with my son. But then one day I looked at the scrapbook that that same woman had created. And on October 17th, 2017, three families had gotten together to talk about how they could form an Orthodox church in Columbus, Mississippi. So while I was doing my own DMT experience with the intention of finding the Orthodox church, these other people were sitting there that night saying, how do we start an Orthodox church? So does that mean I manifested the Orthodox church? Or does that mean we're just all in this spider web acting stuff out for some greater power? I don't know. But that's my DMT Orthodox conversion story.
No, it's interesting. I mean, it's something.
Nobody in my church knows about that. But
so, you know,
watch this video either, so it doesn't matter.
The way you mentioned magic, I think we would somewhat disagree on that too. Like, I think of magic as just intention. You know, like if I write down a list, I'm beholden to this list. I'm more likely to do the stuff on this list and carry out the activities if I didn't do it. Or if I put my passion and effort into something I really want to do. If I just sat in my room and just meditated on it, like for instance, if I said, hey, I want to become the top podcaster in the world. You know, I want to become the next Joe Rogan or Lex Friedman or whatever. If I just sat in my room and meditated on it or did rituals and magic and stuff like that, nothing's going to happen. But maybe if I meditated on it and then I start, you know, getting top guests, upping my game, making it look and sound and as good as possible, having the best guests as possible and just did it that way. That's how I think about like magic and the way people perceive magic is it's like you're tying ritual to intention, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah, no, I agree with you. I don't. I don't know exactly where we disagree on that, but
no. I just don't. You said magic. I just assume, and then maybe that's my fault for assuming. But when people say magic or ritual magic, they usually associate that with like some sort of supernatural element, is where you don't have to put in the work. I've noticed that.
That's what you're saying. Yeah. Cause like for example, the Orthodox Church for me is me saying I'm gonna submit my will to God's will, whereas magic would be no, this is what I want to do. Like neuro-linguistic programming, instead of saying, man, I'm an idiot, you know, this was awful, and then I start believing it and I do become an idiot, you kind of have to have that arrogance to be like, I am Joe Rogan, this is the best podcast. And then even if you are being delusional, you may actually become the lie that you're telling yourself, because it's not a lie, because you're just doing it, which is kind of what I did. I quit my teaching job last minute, which really pissed a lot of people off, because I guess you're not supposed to do that. And I'm over here thinking, yeah, I burned some bridges. I'm never going to go over that bridge again. What can they do to me? Like, tell me I can't teach anymore? I don't want to teach. I wasn't teaching anyway. I was participating in a corrupt system of lies and just making money of glorified daycare, you know, for young adults.
Why?
I feel like I've taught more since I left that world and actually given a platform for creative writers to actually do stuff.
Why orthodoxy? Like, you seem like you know a lot, obviously, about history and philosophy and stuff. Like, why not Gnosticism, which seems to be more closer to the root of these ideas? Like, meaning, there's a clear line from Plato and his idea of, you know, Gnosticos and all that kind of stuff that leads to you know, Neoplatonism, and then you have a lot of the ancient Catholic mystics and stuff drawing from Plato's theory of forms and things like that. So why choose something that isn't really as close to the root as, like, let's say, Gnosticism?
There was a time when I thought Gnosticism was the thing, but I actually reread Elaine Pagel's Gnostic Gospels, and it's one of the most unacademic things I've ever read, because when I read it now, she's just basically saying Gnosticism is all about not, you know, seeking out knowledge, which is cool. Mainstream Christianity is lame. Therefore, Gnosticism is the real Christianity. I mean, that's essentially her thesis in that book. But I think Orthodoxy, and this is, I don't know any Orthodox person other than P.D. Newman who's going to agree with this, because this kind of comes out of his own independent research. Neoplatonism is the language that the early Christians used when creating and compiling the Gospels. I think part of the problem is Orthodoxy is so different from how we in America perceive what Christianity is supposed to be, to the point where, you know, one priest may tell you one thing in America, another priest is going to tell you something different, because it's such a mental thing. Like Father Seraphim Rose, who I do believe will be canonized as a saint, because he's already being venerated as a saint by people, and that's literally how you become a saint. People venerate you, and then the church says, okay, you're a saint. But anyway, he talks about kind of acquiring that peasant mind, which is basically meaning you... Oh, it's so hard to put into words, because it's like, I'm not talking about superstition, but I'm talking about, well, just what you were saying, like the Neoplatonism, which I feel like the Gnostics were seeking that truth and trying to do their own thing, but it was all culty and fringy, and there was, well, obviously it didn't go anywhere, because the only thing we know about the Gnostics is what people who were anti-Gnostic wrote about them.
Right. So, I mean, actually, I was going to tell you, there's, if you want a history, a deep history of Gnosticism, there's these things on Audible called the Great Courses. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Okay.
There's one, it's called Gnosticism from Nag Hammadi to the Gospel of Judas. And I mean, yeah, it talks like Valentinius, all, you know, you mentioned, or Valentinus, mm-hmm. you mentioned all the people opposed. It's like the same, that's the same way we know about Jesus, is all the people opposed to Jesus, other than like the Pontius Pilate stone and a couple other things. You know, that's how we know about a lot of things throughout history, is the opposition or the enemies or whatever the case may be. And that even goes for other cultures like the Egyptians, and you find out about like the sea people and stuff like that. So but yeah, I mean, that's a great resource for, and I know what you're saying about the Elaine Pagel stuff. She doesn't really even get into like the archons and stuff.
No,
like that,
she
really.
Had an axe to grind. You know, her book on the devil. She lost her husband and her son or something, and so she writes this book about how the devil was like invented. I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
I used to really like Elaine Pagels, but then when I got older, I look at her stuff and I just think,
yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, it goes back to the whole Christmas thing. I mean, people can just get away with saying totally wrong anti-Christian stuff, and when
there's
you ask
lots of stuff, I mean,
where does it come from, they can't tell you, because they automatically accept it because they're so pro anything that puts down Christianity.
I mean, have you read that book, The Immortality Key by Brian Murescu, about like, you know, the Holy Grail and all these things being tied to psychedelics and initiation, going back all the way to the Eleusinian mysteries?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's some things I have some problems with in that book, and I've been open about that in the past, but I do think there's good knowledge in there, and he actually was able to find physical evidence of, like, ergot and other psychoactive compounds on a lot of these, you know, pots and pottery and stuff like that, to prove that these things, you know, psychoactive compounds were connected to it. And the idea of dying before you die, this idea that, like, you know, a lot of these mystery schools... You know, let's just take the Eleusinian mysteries for an example. The greater mysteries, everybody had to participate once in their life, but you could only participate once in your life. Hence, you have Alcibiades profaning the Eleusinian mysteries in 405 at a dinner party, or 405 BC, you know, and stuff like that. So they go through this ritual once in their life, And, you know, you have some quotes from Plato and the Phaedo about it. You have some other people quoting, you know, a lot of famous Greeks throughout history. And they all talk about this idea of like there being more and the idea of dying before you die. And that kind of correlates to what we're talking about with the idea of like the precursor for the religions that we know of, the Abrahamic religions, in the sense that a lot of what we know in terms of religion comes from these philosophies. And obviously you have Eastern philosophy, which you get more of the non-duality and that kind of stuff. But the, you know, the Platonic ideas like the theory of forms, the allegory of the cave, you know, mm-hmm. the idea of Atlantis and the Republic and all that kind of stuff. I mean, all those are like transcend that time and were then used by, like I said, like you know, going into Neoplatonism and then leading to Gnosticism and early Christianity. I guess what I'm trying to say is with this, I feel like I'm not saying psychedelics are at the root of all this stuff, but for me, I've never had any day-to-day experience or mystical experience in my like waking life, but I've had tons via psychedelics, via meditation, via lucid dreaming, altered states of consciousness. So I guess for me, this idea that there's some natural, supernatural thing happening, you know, that we can perceive at any time or connect with at any time, I don't feel that, but I do feel it in altered states of consciousness. So I think that it makes sense to me that a lot of the stuff, like our idea of metaphysics, is predicated on altered states of consciousness. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, no, I agree with that 100%. I mean, that's why when you go into church, there's icons and there's incense, and you're not speaking, you're chanting or singing everything. So you're absolutely putting yourself in an altered state of consciousness. And just the whole thing about Gnosticism, it was kind of my interest in Gnosticism that led me to Orthodoxy, but I don't believe in this whole, like, the body is innately evil and the demiurge and all this stuff where, like, I get now why the church considers Gnosticism a heresy, because even though there's some stuff in there that my soul wants to gravitate towards, there's also other stuff where it's like, why is that the conclusion? I don't, and also my other thing, you know, you asked why not Gnosticism. There is no Gnosticism anymore. It just goes back to people who call themselves Druids. It's like, dude, show me the Druid rituals that you are using to live your Druid life. I'm not interested, and that's okay. I'm not, if that's your thing, I don't have to respect it, but I can respect you for doing it. Like, you do it, but there's no such thing as Gnosticism anymore. So if there's someone,
well, yeah, I mean, in terms of, I mean, you could study Gnosticism. You, yeah.
Well, you can study what little we know about what their beliefs were. And pretty much all that's coming from,
yeah,
people,
the Library of Nag Hammadi.
Right. You can read
the Essenes, right, and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah. And Glory to God in 1947, that stuff was discovered. And that's cool. We can read their sacred literature, but anyone who's trying to sell you, hey, you can come join my Gnostic church, I have no interest in revivalist religions, because that's not the real thing. So the reason I chose Orthodoxy was, as an academic, I knew that the Eastern Orthodox Church has essentially been doing the same thing for over 2,000 years. Now, the cool thing about Orthodoxy, unlike Roman Catholicism, is they didn't obliterate the culture. They didn't assimilate the cultures they went into. They let their cultures kind of keep their customs. So that's why Russian Orthodoxy, Greek Orthodoxy, Armenian Orthodoxy has different flavors to it, because I guess that was kind of the genius of their missionaries, where it's like, let the people keep their customs and traditions. Whereas I think the Roman Catholics are more famous for just saying like, no, you can't have that anymore. And then you get stuff like voodoo, where it was hidden, but they were still practicing it. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it does. And you know,
that Gnosticism, Freemasonry, occultism, all eventually brought me to the Orthodox Church. And like I said before, I was able to receive it because I'd already gone through those initiations and those studies.
For me, it comes down to like I said, I mean, I'm very familiar with all this stuff, having had to go to Catholic schools until I was in middle school. You know, you look at the Old Testament, you have a very vengeful God who is, you know, saying, don't take anybody else's name but me, or don't do this and don't do that. There's a wrath there, you know. And then you get to the New Testament, it's like, oh, we love, you know, God's love. He loves you. He's forgiving and blah, 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 blah. It just reeks of human to me, if that makes, like, there's no, I don't feel the, you know, did God change his mind? If he's all-knowing, ever-present, you know, whatever, why would he, you know, he should know that that's going to happen in the future. Or, you know what I'm saying? So it's like things like that, where I'm like, okay, well, I don't know. I just, for me, I do feel like there's something more to all this. We are living, breathing magic. And that's why I'm just not tying myself to anything. But I respect people like you who do their homework, who do pick up something and say, you know what, this is what I am, or this is, I'm feeling this, and this is what I'm going to go with. And I hope everybody finds that for themselves, whatever that is, whether it's art, music, religion, spirituality, you know, whatever it may be. I think we should all be so lucky. But like I said, I just feel like there's a lot of contradiction stuff. And the more, I don't know. The reason why I asked you that question, though, was because I feel like it's a game of telephone, history telephone, where the further you get away from the root of what's happening, the more you become ingrained in whatever the dogma of the day is to a certain degree. But I'm not saying that about necessarily anything specifically, just that that's kind of what's happening. But again, there's an, we all are influenced by everything every day, so it's almost impossible to escape that. And actually, when you see somebody who is truly original, or brings an original art or creativity or presence or music or whatever, you know, you're gravitated towards, because you're like, wow, this is crazy, or this is so unique and so unusual. I mean, that's what got me into like jam bands and Phish. There's a song by Phish, one of the first songs I ever heard from this CD called Rift. Back in the day, and the song starts, it's called Way. The first, and Phish is not like an aggressive band, they're a very hippie mellow, but the song starts out, it goes, I'd like to cut your head off so I can weigh it, what do you say, 5 pounds, 6 pounds, seven, you know, it goes into this whole thing. So when you look at that, it's like, okay, well, this is kind of different, you know. And I was raised on like classic rock and stuff like that. So, yeah, I don't know. I feel like, you know, something, you can learn something from each culture, each religion, each thing. So I respect the fact that you've found what that is for yourself, and you're sticking to it, and you're putting in the work. And I think that that takes a lot of time and dedication, and, yeah, man, just, you know, keep doing what you're doing. And, I think that you're obviously on your path, for what you're doing. And I think that it's important that we all find whatever that path is for ourselves. And it's not easy to find. And like whenever you're on a path of knowledge or whatever, it sucks a lot of time, a lot of energy. There's a lot of second guessing and questioning and things like that. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's weird because sometimes we feel like I'm doing this. And then other times it feels like it's doing it to me. Which I think it really is more of the latter. You know, we're maybe we get imprinted when we're young, and we gravitate towards certain things, but it's definitely made my life richer. You know, my experiences with ghosts or spirits or demons or aliens or whatever they are. I mean, even my Charles Manson thing, as far as like me actually corresponding with Charles Manson after Shane died, I just wrote Charles Manson because I wanted him to know that this nice guy, he wouldn't be hearing from anymore. And it was so funny. I got home from work and I only had a few minutes, so I had to get in the car and drive out to night school. And my dad was like, you got a letter. And he wasn't happy. you know, I mean, he already thought that Shane was a bad influence, and now Shane had died and caused me grief. And here's this letter from Charles Manson, who knows what my dad was thinking. And you know, and it was in the aftermath of Shane's death. So, you know, here's my dad not being insensitive, but kind of just being like, ugh! And I go in my room and I open this letter, and Charles Manson in the letter said, Shane's not dead. You know, don't ever say that again. Shane was just here, you know. And it was written in that Charles Manson way, where it was more like, you know, he was just here with the wham blam and the juke, you know. It was classic Charles Manson. Unfortunately, after my son was born and I had a few ghostly experiences, I threw that letter away. And the very next day at work, I'm on the internet and I read this article about how much letters letters from Charles Manson go for. And I thought, you know, I specifically threw this letter away because I didn't want, like, to get into any karmic entanglement of, like, profiting off of the death of Sharon Tate. And then, like, within 24 hours of throwing the letter away, I'm seeing this article about how much money I could make on the letter. And this was before Charles Manson was even dead. So I kind of saw that as a sign from the universe that was like, yeah, good thing you threw away the letter. Even though every time I tell people that story, they're like, you're an idiot. Why did you throw that away? But anyway, I just love the idea of me coming home sad about my friend's death and my dad being like, ugh, Charles Manson. And then Charles Manson's actually being really sweet and being like, no, dude, Shane was just here, man. We were just, you know, chewing the fat. You know, he's not dead. So.
Yeah, that's crazy. Let's go back to Charles Manson a little bit. Have you read Chaos?
I have not read Chaos. It sounds okay.
You
awesome.
Should read Chaos. No, you absolutely need to read Chaos.
Okay.
You find out things like, like Helter Skelter, written by Vincent Bugliosi, I believe is his name. You know, you find out in this book Chaos, he was kind of a liar. And he found things like in the house, like, you know, and I don't want to ruin too much, but I'll just go through a couple of the things. We'll do an episode on this in the future, 'cause I want to do like a recap of this book. But, he supposedly the police found a tape made by Roman Polanski in the walls after the crime was committed, where it showed Polanski videotaping Tate. He was forcing Sharon to have sex with two other dudes while he videotaped, which is kind of messed up. You know, he was connected with a lot of like shady Eastern European drug dealer types who were like profiting off of like the hippie movement and stuff like that.
Right.
You have this guy named Reeve Whitson, who was around a lot, who was also connected to like the CIA. Manson knew the guy, and I didn't know a lot of this, but Manson knew the guy, Melcher, who lived at the house previously. Right. Yeah. And actually he turned him down for like a record contract. And Melcher claimed he didn't even know who Charles Manson was aside from turning him down. But that's not true, because this guy found evidence that, Charles Manson was like sending his girls to have sex with like Melcher and his, you know, producer friends and stuff like that. So there was a connection there. A lot of famous people knew about Manson at the time. You know, Manson, they say he used LSD to brainwash, you know, get these women and girls into a suggestive state, and then would give them speed later on, during like the years of like the crime and stuff like that. So actually, I didn't know this, but that was like a popular transition in the Haight-Ashbury / hippie scene, was to start out using LSD and then slowly work your way towards speed. I didn't know that that was like a thing, but apparently it was a big thing.
I didn't know that either.
And both LSD and speed were being studied by the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, which was started all the way back in the 60s and was just shut down after this guy, Tom O'Neill, released this book, and he thinks that it might have had something to do with him releasing this book about how MK Ultra was basically funding this. There was these two guys, David Smith and Roger Smith. Roger Smith was Charles Manson's like handler or probation officer, something like that, but he kept getting him out of like crimes that would put anybody away forever. Right. And somehow he kept getting let out, kept getting LSD somehow. And then the other guy, David Smith, was a farm. They both ran the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, both these Smiths. And Dave Smith was a pharmacologist who, before that, working there, he was testing LSD on mice and rats. And then they would use speed, too. And that's how they came up with the famous experiment where, you know, they give the mice speed or rat speed, and then they eventually become aggressive with each other, and they're overpopulated, and they attack each other, kind of a thing. And then you see that represented in the hippie/human culture, too, as I mentioned, hippies using LSD and then switching to speed and becoming violent with each other. So, yeah, there's a lot of crazy stuff. Roger, okay, so then you find out about this guy named Jolly West, and he was in the military early on in his career, but he became like this go-to mind guru for the military and the CIA and stuff. And he predicted all these LSD cults. Gottlieb, who was the head of, you know, the CIA at the time, funded mass conversion program and funded it through MK Ultra. Oh, the Jolly West guy supposedly would dress up like a hippie, but it was clear that he was like a conservative guy, just like pretending, almost like you see like some dude at a concert, like a cop trying to sell drugs or something like that. And he worked with LSD all the way back from the 50s, though. And he was the dude, like when all the prisoners of war came back from the Korean War, he would deprogram them. He deprogrammed 83 prisoners, supposedly. You know, the other thing I found out too, which was interesting, and I was thinking about this, I wonder if he used LSD to deprogram these prisoners of war because they had all that trauma. Maybe he used LSD on them to kind of get them out of that. You have Dulles, you know, funding Gottlieb and the MK Ultra because they were worried that the Soviets were going to get us with all this like mind control stuff. It was like a kind of a response to what we thought that the Soviets were going to do, but then they got a little taste of it and saw all the potential with all of the mind control stuff. And they're like, okay, no, we're going to do more of this stuff. And then 1953, you have MK Ultra, which was born. The main focus was mind control to prevent Soviet brainwashing. And then the power and greed took over. And actually, most people don't know, there's 149 sub-ops that were part of MK Ultra, where they studied things like magnetic stuff, you know, magnetic energy, chemicals on people, hypnosis, ESP, you know, et cetera, everything having to do with the mind. If you've ever heard about the one guy that killed the elephant with LSD, that was Jolly West, too. Jolly West is actually the one that did that. Everybody's, I think, heard of Midnight Climax if you listen to the Joe Rogan podcast, because he talks about it all the time. But that's where in MK Ultra, they had three safe houses, they were called, but they were like bordellos. And there was this dude through a two-way mirror that would watch. They would dose the John with LSD, and then the prostitute would have sex with them. But supposedly, reading this, there was some dude behind the two-way mirror, I forget the guy's name, but he had like a mini cooler and he was just mixing martinis the whole time, just watching all this shit happen, which is crazy to think about. There's some dude with a mini cooler just observing all this crazy stuff go down. I'm trying to think what else. Also Jolly West, this mind control guru guy who's been using LSD and different compounds on people, and you know, the idea was to replace people's true thoughts or true memories with fake or falsified memories, almost like what's it called? Hypnotherapy. Was it regression? You can plant ideas in people's heads, kind of a thing. So they used hypnosis a lot, too. He was also connected to Jack Ruby and the JFK situation, which is kind of weird. He got to interview Jack Ruby alone for a while before, I think after he had killed what's his face, and before, while he was on trial. As far as we know, two people died from MK Ultra. One of them was Frank Olson, who's part of that documentary on Netflix called Wormwood, where he was part of the CIA, but he went to some party they had and he accidentally got dosed on purpose. And then the next day he went into some weird depression because he didn't understand what was going on, and then jumped out of a window and killed himself. And then later on, his son, you know, pushed hard and they got all this stuff uncovered. So anyways, I don't want to ruin anything. That's actually not even the juiciest stuff, but I just want to give people a general idea of, like,
oh yeah,
you think that I'm not a conspiracy guy at all. Okay. I'm not, like, I just don't waste my time on it. I know that a small amount of them do exist, but when you read this book, you realize, I don't think that, like, even that Jolly West guy that was doing all these tests on people with LSD and mind control, I don't think he was some magician or just really understood what he was doing. Like, you think some guy at the top just knows he's going to pull all the strings. And I don't think of it like that. I just think that from reading this, you realize how crazy people are, in the sense that what they're willing to do for whatever reason, if they think that there's, like, a purpose to it, right? Like, how far mm-hmm. they're willing to go. And you get, like, even, like, Nazi testing type vibes from some of the shit that they were doing. So, yeah, I mean, I think everybody should read this book, Chaos, because I didn't know a ton about the Manson murders, but you learn a ton, and you realize it was no accident. Manson had been to that house before.
Oh, yeah.
There was parties there all the time with people that ran in the same circles. There was a lot of connections to all that stuff. And then on top of that, you get the second wave of this book, which is all about, like, mind control, CIA, MK Ultra, all that kind of stuff. So
does the book have the picture of, it's like Bugliosi's team, I guess it is?
And so I have both. I don't know, I'd have to pull up my Kindle, but I have the Audible. On the Audible, they do give you the notes. Here, let me see if I can pull up the pictures on it.
Well, I believe it was Christopher Knowles, the Secret Sun guy. He shared a picture before he dipped off of social media, and I did not save the picture. But it's Bugliosi's, like, legal team, and I can't remember if they had won the case yet, or if it was just the 1 year anniversary. I think it was on the 1 year anniversary of the murders, or the,
right,
the tape, because the Libyanka happened last night. But in the picture, there's, like, you know, it's men and women, but, like, a woman has an X drawn on her head, like she's a Manson girl, and they're holding like a noose. Is this? I'm just wondering.
There's a bunch. Yeah, there's a bunch of pictures. I don't.
That picture is included in the book because I remember seeing that.
Yeah, there are a bunch of pictures.
And thinking that's insane. But that, of course, that picture was taken at a time where they just thought, we can take this picture and no one's ever going to see it. But you're looking at the picture and you're thinking, these are people who are not only making a mockery of the murders, but it also has this ritualistic aspect to it, which is why I think they actually posed for it on the anniversary of the death. And it just also goes to show that, yeah, Bugliosi didn't care. He was making a name for himself. He wrote this fictitious book, Helter Skelter. I've got it on I actually have Shane's copy on my shelf. I've never read the book. I don't really have any interest in reading it, because when I think of it, I think of every baby boomer who flips out when they find out I've communicated with Charles Manson, or they flip out when they find out I've been in bands that covered his music, and they just think it's so hideous and despicable. And it's like, yeah, you were programmed to think that. You went a decade with that crammed down your throat, and we still get Charles Manson stuff every couple of years. Not like the good stuff, like Chaos, but just another crappy made for TV movie, or just like, hey kids, you never heard of Charles Manson, but he's the American boogeyman. You know, it is a psyop. It is a conspiracy. People came together to make this happen. He's the ultimate scapegoat. You think, yeah, Freemasons are scapegoats, and they are, but man, Charles Manson.
Well,
the evil hippie. And I love the whole fact that we think of Haight Ashbury and the Beatles and LSD as counterculture. It's not. It is the culture. We were raised to think that it's counterculture, but it's like, no, the counterculture is in fact the culture.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's more Grateful Dead's associated with Haight Ashbury. And actually, Grateful Dead was counterculture because they were doing the electric Kool-Aid acid tests with Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters and all that kind of stuff.
But it's not counterculture. It's marketed that way, but the government.
Well, but that I mean, you'll if you read Chaos, you'll see, like,
yeah, there was hippies and stuff like that, but it was all hippies, like, kind of coming to that one specific area. Like, I think the Summer of Love, they estimated 100,000 arrived in, you know, which is a lot of people. So obviously those people are coming from somewhere. Now, like, I don't, when you said the Beatles, I don't think of the Beatles as counterculture. I do think them as pop culture, but I don't think the Grateful Dead is pop culture. I think the Grateful Dead is counterculture because they're two very different things. Where the Beatles might have done psychedelics, literally the Grateful Dead had Owsley and all the people all associated with getting all the LSD and the electric lead acid test and all that stuff out there. So I think that there's, you know, an element of what you're saying is true. I do think that that was more in the public at the time, but I do think that there were people that were a little bit more out there than some of the other people.
Well, sure. Like, the Beatles are like the most famous example. And of course, I think George Harrison, he talks about when he went to Haight-Ashbury, he was like, this is depressing. This is not what I was expecting. And yeah. And I love the whole story about, you know, the Revolver song, Dr. Robert, literally being about some doctor who laced their coffee with acid. And the first time the Beatles tripped on acid, it's because a handler dosed them without their consent. That's weird.
All right.
You know, what's all that about?
Shout out to Old Vets Symposium. I don't know who this benefactor is, but this guy just donated $40 on Super Chats. Thank you.
All right.
Old Vets Symposium. I don't know who you are, but apparently the aliens helped him win $300 at the casino. Dude, you didn't have to do that. I appreciate it. But by the way, that's Shane. This dude's donating to our own show that he's on right now, which I appreciate.
I prefer the second one. I know you won't read the second one, but I had to donate because the second one's very important.
Okay, yeah. Toby, you can screw off according to... Oh, it looks like there's a whole list. Hold on. Toby, Tara, and Chase.
$20 well spent to flip a middle finger to those three.
Oh, got him.
So, is this what your $20 just bought you? There you go.
Yeah, yeah, middle finger emoji. It was well worth the $20.
Go listen to some Grateful Dead.
There you go. Well, I think we should wrap it up here. I'd like to have you back on in the future. You know, maybe we can, since I didn't know you knew, so I mean, I kind of had an idea from our back and forth before we did the podcast, but maybe we can do one specifically on like religion or like Jesus or whatever next time, because you know, while I'm not super religious, I do love those conversations. And I definitely learn every time we have like the back and forth, like, I would much rather have somebody come on, that's well researched like you and have differing points of view and opinions and stuff like that, then have somebody come on that just like agrees the whole time. You know what I'm saying? There's more to be gained from those kind of that, like, friction, you know? So,
oh yeah, sure.
Yeah. But I would like to have you back on where we talk about, like, you know, the history or, you know, what we know about, like, you know, Jesus and theology and things like that. So.
I've loved this, man. I mean, I already was kind of a fan and, yeah, dude, this is,
y'all, we can do anything. I mean, even maybe get you on next time too. Maybe we can get you on with PD and you know, we can talk about all sorts of Masonic and esoteric stuff and all that kind of stuff.
Let's do that. If that's cool with you and PD's down, I think it would be great to have the two of us on together, because there was so many times in this interview where I knew what I wanted to say. And then I start talking. I just want to be like, Danny, you know what I'm trying to say, you know, cause he's the man that remembers everything he reads, and he's just a genius.
Yeah.
And I think just the round table conversation would just,
I love the books that he reads too and posts. Like, they're such esoteric and obscure, like, and you know, pre-Socratic philosophy and different philosophers, and he's finding all these crazy books that I didn't even know exist out there. So
yeah, he is the prophet who in his own town, nobody knows he's there. People don't realize what he knows, and the people who kind of get it are immediately like, oh no, you know, there's so many PD haters, and it's just because, like, yeah, you feel stupid when you're around him, don't you? like he's just a cool, normal guy that knows some great stuff because he puts in the work, y'all. Like, he's actually on his way to Australia right now. I don't know if he's landed yet, but he's on his
good
way.
Good day, mate. put another shrimp on the barbie for us. Shout out to Ken.
Some psychedelic shrimp.
We actually have a Mind Escape first tonight as well. It looks like we have our first on-air divorce between Tara and Shane. It's happening live on our live chat.
Good riddance.
Papers have been served. I don't know what's going on here.
Good riddance.
Oh, my God.
You said that you were in a bad mood, Shane.
Yeah.
Shane was crabby.
I did too, what I say.
When he jumped on, I'm like, dude, you are crabby, bro.
The first thing I said, they said, you look like you're in a bad mood. And what did I say? I'm married. I'm always in a bad mood.
Yeah, Alec really loved. Alec loved that joke.
I'm just jealous, man. I'm just jealous.
Well, guess what, guys? I love my wife to death, so no fights here.
Awesome.
You guys do you. I'll do me. But anyways,
Mrs. Mike.
Cheers.
Oh, my wife will definitely love me to death at some point. So if you don't hear from me.
Hopefully you get smothered with love. Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. Again, perfect erotic novel. Bigfoot, tiny dick.
That's why Bigfoot's so mad. That's why he's killing people.
Uh-oh. But yeah, so let's wrap it up here. Again, if you are interested and you love occult fiction and horror fiction and all that, check out Alec has his publishing company, which is called Werecat Books. And you can check out his book. I have his book link down below to his Amazon page. And yeah, you know, I haven't read it yet, but I'm willing to read it, actually, to be honest with you. I told him I haven't read fiction in a while, but I might make a special case just to read his work. I like supporting our guests. His book is called Scratch on the Lock. And yeah, you can check out, again, those links down below. He also has a YouTube channel, which you should check out and subscribe. And let's see here. And yeah, if you want to support Mind Escape, all you have to do is click the Linktree link down below. Again, we have a Patreon that I just restructured. For just $2 a month, you'll get exclusive access to our guest segments and things that you can't find on our audio or YouTube platform. And let's see here. We have a merch store, which I have a ton of designs, cool designs, esoteric designs. Go check that out. And yeah, if you're watching on YouTube, which we do all of our shows live on YouTube. If you're watching on YouTube, please check out our audio platform stuff. We do have video podcasts on Spotify, and we are on Apple Podcasts as well. If you want to leave us a nice review, we'd really appreciate that. And also, you know, hit the like button if you're watching right now on YouTube or, you know, whatever. We'd appreciate that as well. As we leave out of here, I am going to play the trailer for our upcoming documentary, which I will keep doing until it premieres. And I think that's about... Oh, yeah. Go check out our other podcast that Shane and I do. And shout out to Toby, who's in here in the chat. It's called the Roswell UFO Symposium. We just did a really good episode a couple nights ago. I feel like we hit on a couple real deep topics with the phenomenon. And we have a bunch of cool guests coming up, top, you know, minds in the field, as well as, you know, we're going to start doing our episodes 11 p.m. Eastern time every Sunday night. So you can tune in regularly to the Roswell UFO Symposium. And the link tree for that is down below. Is there anything else you want to say, Alec, before we get out of here?
Keep watching the stars and don't trip on your dick.
All right. Those are good ones. And
I want that t-shirt.
So
thank you, y'all. This has been a blast.
And yeah, shout out to Tara, shout out to Chase, shout out to Toby, 4.5 fingers. Who else? Corbeck. Who else did we have in here? B. Tons of people. And we really appreciate all the love. Nicholas down there at the bottom. But yeah, I just want to say, you know, we love everybody. Stay safe out there, and here is the trailer for our upcoming documentary, As Within, So Without, From UFOs to DMT. Here we go.
Is it real or is it not? That's what you're asking me.
I still, to this day, can't find any rational explanation for what I saw.
Extremely intelligent, apparently highly advanced, hyper-technological being.
I think that we just don't look at the perception of reality in the right way yet.
It got very close to the point that I could see just one big light, and then it stopped, and then it shot up in the sky.
You know you're not dreaming, but you wonder how real any of it really is.
It dawned on me. It was real. This took place. But then I still didn't do anything with it. Never said anything to anybody.
There is some mind-altering aspect to these UFO encounters. A lot of people get a sense of missing time.
I noticed that these three stars were kind of in a formation. It was a triangular formation.
Condensed into entities or beings that you interact with who are sentient.
The chemicals which are going into our brain are making the unconscious archetypes come alive.
How things evolve from pure energy to matter.
Definitely was kind of a paradigm shifting moment.
And as we continue to evolve in our own consciousness, we will perceive of new modes of interpretation, but that may be dependent upon how this supposed phenomenon reveals itself to us.
I'm not sure why we discredit the human experience when it's not in alignment with our current belief system.
It's important to consider that, one, we don't really understand what our minds do under the influence of psychedelics.
They all attest to the reality of some other realm. You call it the paranormal, doesn't matter what you call it, spiritual realm, supernatural, metaphysical, doesn't matter.
The fact that we're essentially vibrating energy in a sense, and that when this experience is over, that particular energy transforms and doesn't die, because it can't die, fills me with a lot of comfort that there is something else after this so-called here and now.
They show you how much of your reality is subjective and fragile and capable of being influenced by a psychedelic drug.
Coming from a scientific background, you come up with explanations that range from geomagnetic to atmospheric to something that's physical in nature.
There's a lot more out there that we don't know than we do know.
So the entire system, the human body, is effectively a stimulation response machine.
I think something's here. I don't know what it is. I don't know where it's from. It could be extraterrestrials.
Until it made a full rotation and then it just hit an insane speed and just shot up straight into the atmosphere.
I think that there's compelling evidence that psychedelics have played a significant role in human evolution over a long period of time.
That our view of reality, the reality that we experience on a day-to-day basis, seems to be this very, very thin slice of something far larger and far more complex. For reasons that we
never communicated
clear about it,
never said
but I don't see that
as within, so without. From UFOs to DMT.